You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz. What are you doing over the holiday break in December? Well, if you're like me, you're writing, you're outlining, you're getting your work done, and you're getting a head start to the new year. So, join me for a 10-day screenplay online workshop during the holiday break. Some days you'll have to commit to an hour of work, other days 3 hours of work, but in the end you'll have a very tight 40 to 60 scene breakdown of your film. Don't have an idea? Worry not, that's day one. By day three we will have our character maps and dive into the major plot points that need to happen to the film, then expand from there to really map out each act of your screenplay. It's the holidays, which means it's time to work to get ahead on your masterpiece on screen. A link to register for the workshop can be found at drinkswithtony.com. That's the 10-day screenplay outline workshop happening during the holiday break, December 22nd through January 2nd. Go to drinkswithtony.com for the link to register. Let's make some movies. And now, on with the show.
Hi, I'm H. Lee Barnes, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show. Yeah.
Your books talk to you. Mine do, too. They tell me I'm doing it wrong. We'll have to discuss that in a minute. All right. You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have H. Lee Barnes. He's the author of Emerald City Blues, a novel. Lee, how are you?
I'm swell. How are you?
I'm pretty good myself. I'm about to crack open some sparkling water here and go hard. They say it's, I don't know how to pronounce this, but I think it's La Croix.
La Croix.
I don't know. You say it way better than I do. We were talking before we started recording about,
I have my own.
What's yours? I have my own sparkling.
It's just ordinary ice.
Ice and water. There we go. The thing that keeps us going. If we don't have water, we die. We're made of water. We're surrounded by water. Everything's water.
Except in the desert.
Except in the desert. Then there's some problems. No, we were discussing rejection a minute ago, and you were relating it to the Free Cell game that you lost. Is it called Free Cell?
Free Cell, yes.
Yeah, I like playing that game. That's a fun one.
Yeah. It's pretty easy to actually beat most of them, but then every once in a while, you make that bad move. Kind of like getting married.
Have you been married?
Tried it twice.
Yeah, I've been married once. Yeah. What's your longest marriage? What was your longest marriage?
2 years and 2 months.
Oh my God! I feel like with that you make great decisions early on. See, I was almost 14 years, but I think my marriage ended 9 years earlier. I just didn't know it yet.
Thank you. Yeah, there you go. That's exactly. Yeah, yeah. I guess I caught on to that. Oh, it's over with.
Yeah.
She was a raging, jealous woman when she lost her temper. And the second one just simply wouldn't do anything. And when I asked her for the divorce, she said, but I didn't do anything. And I said, that's exactly it.
As you carried her off the sloth couch over to the sloth car to take her to the sloth hotel. No, the jealousy thing is huge, man, because I was looking back over, I still do this thing called Facebook sometimes, but it shows you your memories from like 15 years ago. And I was hosting an event for a literary fest in San Francisco, and the girl that I was dating at the time, I was I was hosting a 4-hour event and there was no water for me. So I had to be on stage every 5 seconds. And what I was doing was just taking sips of my flask of whiskey. So by the time I got on to do my set of storytelling, it wasn't great. And the video's still on YouTube. And in the little caption it says, yeah, and my girlfriend Leah at the time, we'll use real names so we can get sued here. My girlfriend Leah at the time, she was so mad that other women might be attracted to me that she wouldn't go get me water. And she sat there and she texted on her Blueberry the whole time. And guess what? I stayed with her another like 8 months. That's how insane I am. I should have just walked off that stage, drove in a car far away, and moved to another city.
You should have. I agree. I agree. You should have. Yes. I mean, water is important.
But the
Ladies.
jealousy, the I'm on stage and her worry about, oh, I think other ladies like you. And I'm like, what am I supposed to do? Not have charisma in front of an audience just in case a woman might be attracted to me in row 3, seat R?
She should wait until you get the note passed up to you. Then get jealous,
I
especially
never get.
if you
I
read.
don't get
If
notes.
you read, you don't. No, when they passed up to me, I just pick them up and kiss them and
Right.
goodbye.
Exactly.
Because,
Yeah. Go ahead. Wait, because.
because the worst thing that you can do is pick up a stranger.
Yeah. Oh,
Yeah,
yeah.
true,
Yes.
true, true.
No,
You
I've
don't know.
learned this the hard way along this journey of being a dude and kind of the understanding of the other sex that what's my angle? So would you ever get married again, or is marriage off the table for you now?
Well, at this stage of my life, it's pretty much off the table. Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, my fiance from, okay, you ready for this? Almost 50 years ago,
Yeah.
contacted me again. Now that she's divorced, I mean, she dumped me. She just said, well, the engagement's off and I'll send you your ring. And that was kind of it. And then, 50 years later, she comes on to me again on Facebook. And I don't
Yeah.
know what she was expecting.
Yeah.
So I call her my stalker.
I mean, it could be switched around, or that's kind of a beautiful thing. Like, she's been pining for you for 50 years. She's gone through so much growth. She's gone through therapy. She's created a different world and point of view. You might be missing out on something huge.
No, she's still a yuppie.
Well,
She's not a bad person. She's not a bad person. She's very attractive.
Yeah.
She has her charm and a little bit of charisma that way too. But
Yeah.
yeah, she's pretty much a yuppie. She likes that semi upper, not quite upper middle class lifestyle where you go on vacations 3 times a year and your friends all talk about the terrible things that conservatives do because they're so liberal, but they're really not liberal because they're doing the same things that conservatives do.
Oh, yes. And I feel like there's a lot of that in general in our collective society. I get at this, I don't I have nothing against people who have like money and can do these things. It's when it's their like whole personality, then that scares me. That's when the personality has to keep showing the status as well as I don't I lost what I was saying.
I got to click. I got you. Something came up on the screen to click you out. There, you're back on.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. But go
The
ahead. You were talking about people with money.
your AI wife. You can marry an AI now, from what I understand.
Oh, all the more reason to hate technology.
I know,
What
isn't it? Yeah. It's just
do they
is
think?
what I really need is a was more is more ego bloating in my head. That's what I need, is just someone to sit there and go yes and to me all the time with all my, with, well, not all my ideas are stupid, but a good more than half of them are. So,
yeah, I know that AI can actually put hair on my head on the internet, but it can't actually put hair on my head, you know, so come on. That's it. Only it has, even AI has its limitations.
Well, it's, and the thing with this is what kind of drives me crazy, because you see people presenting themselves even on social media through filters, and then you meet them in real life, and you're like, oh wait, you're like 50 like me. We're like the same age, and you kind of look like you're 35, but it's not because you're taking great care of yourself. It's because you got filters. And so yeah. And that just drives me crazy. Let's see the warts and all and the beauty of it all. And, you know, and because I just feel like our faces and our bodies kind of tell our story. And hey, I'm not Brad Pitt. Marilyn Monroe. None of us are. We're all flawed, beautifully flawed human beings. If we, you know, are just trying to understand and get through life, and then we can just look at each other as see me and I see you, and this is our utter fallibility and absolute imperfection. That's sexy.
Yeah. Okay. I agree with you. I live in a large, well, it's a part of a sister community. I live in five acres in the desert next to a community called Valley Vista, north of, we're 20 north, northeast of Kingland, about 24, 25 miles. But if you go, it's a golfing community, Valley Vista area, isn't there? I mean, if you go over there, the average age of the people around there is deceased. And, and you get used to seeing them for who they are, because they can't disguise it. That's who they are.
Yeah.
And they represent themselves through their conversation and their greetings. And I see them at the clubhouse when I go there to eat. And, you know, it's pretty amazing that these people are just perfectly content to be who they are. Of course, sometimes you have to hear their stories, and they go on and on and on. And I'm going, that's kind of how they go on.
And that's why everyone needs to take writing classes and learn how to craft their stories into something that's like, that's available and interesting, where we can intake it. Because our stories, even the story that can become a book, it's not good even on the first or second draft. It's gotta be reworked. So we pick our stories, and then if we write and write and write, then we kind of learn how to talk about our other stories, maybe with a little bit more editing in our head, because we just know how to edit.
Yeah. In fact, the novel that we're talking about, Emerald City Blues, has a lot of not so much me, but my family story woven into it in small ways. For instance, my mother's from Palouse. My mother's name was Evelyn. My central character goes by the name of Eve, or her name is Eve. That doesn't end it, because my mother's father left the family during the Depression, ostensibly to find work and send money back to the family, but he never returned. My grandmother kept a place at the table for him, a place setting, clean and prepared all the time, waiting for that moment when he was going to sit down and return. And he never did. So how could I not weave that into a story or into a novel that's set in World War II, which celebrates the women of that era and their contributions to the war effort through working in the war industry on the home front? And that's, you know, that obviously it's dedicated to them too. And of course, my editor who passed away, unfortunately. But we have those stories as writers, that emerge sometimes in odd ways in what we're writing. I didn't set out to write my mother's story in any way, but I tapped into it. Why not? Yeah. It's there. It's yours to use. Because she's not going to use it. Not where she is, wherever that is.
Well, I hear there's literary readings in the afterlife, which is just sounds like hell to me.
Yeah. And you know, the weird thing is they never serve barbecue. So I understand. You know, nobody's ever talked about hell as a place where they serve barbecue. Everyone lines up and just gets the barbecue.
Yeah.
No. Well, that would make hell heaven. So, you know, and then Milton would really be confused.
can I get this barbecue angel with a little more sauce? If that's what hell is. I really like the visual of what a beautiful hope that your grandmother had, that your father would come back. And also there's a lot of conflicting emotions there, because it's that's not easy. And wow, she's sure she's giving him a lot of grace at the same time. Is that how you feel, or am I interpreting that in a different way?
Well, there's that. But then there's that remarkable thing called hope.
Yeah.
That carries forward even in when it should long have been defeated.
Yeah.
But hope, but in some people, the hope just continues to exist, or perhaps the ritual of having him waiting for a place setting. No, instead of waiting with anticipation, maybe she's doing it because he isn't there, and this is her revenge.
Oh, look at the emptiness in our family because of this. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's other ways of interpreting that. I don't spend a lot of time with it, but there's we see those stories in our own families in different ways, and we carry them forward. We're sitting down writing, and the next thing you know, we're writing something about, of course, I write about Vietnam. I've written a couple of things about Vietnam and about veterans and stuff like that. And sometimes you're like, oh yeah, well, this actually did happen, or something similar to it happened in my own history. And so it incorporated in there. And why not? It you know, you can't plagiarize yourself.
Yeah. I mean, you can, but you'll go blind.
Yeah, you'll go blind. I didn't know that.
I don't know. I was like, oh, wait, you're plagiarizing. I thought it was the other thing.
what did some people go deaf if they keep telling the same story?
Yeah, yeah.
I know their listeners do.
That's funny. This is what I come across as when I write, because I try to dive into like tragedies of my family at the start, and then I realize that never ever works for me. Whenever I try to dive into it as the story, I can never get there, and then it gets abandoned. But when I work on another story that's kind of from a completely different angle, that I don't think I'm doing anything about my family, all of a sudden, then those things creep in and those themes creep in. And that's I guess, my way. When we have tremendous hurt or tremendous trauma from times in our lives or in our families, it's kind of hard to go directly at it. But sometimes when we go around it, it comes to us in a way that speaks maybe even more volumes to the masses than if we hit it directly.
Right. I agree. I have actually in recent years come across the truth behind all the lies my mother told.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I've always felt was that I was the unwanted child, which I don't think that would be unusual for a writer to feel that.
I think it's a prerequisite.
Or any kind of artist for that matter.
Yeah, yeah.
That desire to be not necessarily wanted, but appreciated later in life. But I did a DNA test several years ago, and the truth is that Barnes was not my father. During the last year of World War II, my mother had an affair with a guy by the name of Lampson, and his daughter became my half sister. She didn't want to have anything to do with me when I tried to contact her because I wanted to know more about it. But my brother-in-law from one of my sister's marriages helped me explore that. And I later wrote my boyhood memoir, which has gotten published. Nobody's interested in an old guy's boyhood memoir. But I found out that this Neil Franklin Lampson established Lampson International, which is a large crane manufacturing operation centered in Kirkland, Washington, but is in Phoenix and I think Dallas and in Australia. And they produce crawler cranes, and the family's quite wealthy. So she didn't want to have anything to do with me, I'm sure, because they thought that perhaps I might seek legal recourse against them. But I don't want anything. I didn't want anything from them, but information. But I put that to rest. But I did write about it in my memoir because it answered a lot of questions. And I had this feeling because I also found out from my cousin Dolores that my Aunt Helen died of sepsis after an illegal abortion, or a backroom abortion is what they did in those eras. And that probably, along with my grandmother probably pounding on my mother about it, stopped my mother from having an abortion, because I'm certain she wanted to be married to Vernon Barnes and live on that wheat farm that the family had. But she was stuck with me and my older sister. Of course, had already been there. That was Barnes's daughter. So there it was, this boy that popped out of her and caused her divorce from the man that she wanted to be with. And I've written that in the boyhood memoir, but there's just nobody that was interested in that kind of hearing about it. The memoir is more complicated than that, but
yeah. I mean, in a way, it's
about a memoir about a boy who was almost destined to become a writer because of the circumstances of his childhood.
Well, I don't know what writer would not want to read that, because I feel like we all have nothing to that extreme. I mean, oh my God, when you find out that there was this lie, big lie in your family, what is the first response that you have when that comes to you like that? What's the first feeling or thought? What do you remember?
Yes, it was not anger, surprisingly enough. Wow. Seeing it as a way, as an explanation for everything that followed. That's about it. I mean, my mother was not, she was probably what you would call an unstable person in some ways, and very stable in others. She's one of those that worked all of her life, but really didn't know how to mother with love until she had her last son. She had a bunch of kids, by the way. She was helping out with different men, and had a couple of affairs beyond just the one with me. There was one, at least one after that. I suspect another as well. Mm-hmm. But it brought clarity, I guess is the best way to say it. Huh. And that clarity was something that, why go on being angry? You can't be angry about it. You know, why take that and focus your attention on live, especially at my age. You know, it's you reach a stage, you say every day is maybe not a blessing, but at least it's there.
Yeah.
So that's the way to look at it.
Do you feel like that you kind of knew there was something off, and then when that lie was exposed, it kind of like put all the pieces together in a way? Or
yeah,
okay,
yeah, I think we have these sensibilities. I think when we're young, that we kind of lose as we age, mm-hmm. because life tends to hardness to certain things, you know. And I think those sensibilities were always there, that they pushed matters in a way that made me realize that something was wrong or something was awry. I just didn't know what it was. And so when that truth came about, and by the way, my older sister and I had contacted Virgil Barnes, who was Vernon Barnes's brother. Vernon Barnes had long since passed away, but we contacted Virgil Barnes at a rest home in Spokane, Washington. And he was adamant. He said, no, Vernon is not your father. And that was almost 20, right at 20 years before I discovered the DNA thing. Mm. So I already had, you know, pretty, and we confronted our mother about it, and she denied it. I mean, yeah. That's the thing. She couldn't accept her own fallibility, I guess.
Yeah. Do you think that's a generational thing where the shame is so bad that maybe they also lie to themselves at that point?
It could be. It could be. It could possibly be. I mean, I don't know, but I think Vernon Barnes was in the service overseas at the time. So it's kind of hard for her to have to get pregnant by him if he's an absentee husband. Uh-huh. So that pretty much explains why he divorced her too. But that's all.
Yeah. So with the other siblings, are you able to be close to some of them, or are the siblings?
Oh, tight? Yeah. Well, I have a half brother that I do not talk to,
mm-hmm.
And I have a half brother that we're pretty close to. He's an artist and a pretty good artist at that.
Yeah.
And so we stay in touch on, he comes down and visits, and then we stay in touch on Facebook. And I have my older sister's niece is like the daughter I never had. So I have family that way.
Yeah.
But the youngest brother, I don't have anything to do with him. He makes all these claims about what he did in the service. He did clandestine operations, which there is no such thing as clandestine operation, either in special forces or your force recon, or you're a SEAL or something like that. And he wasn't. He actually issued uniforms to soldiers, is what he did.
Yeah.
But it's just that I don't abide liars very much. And he's done stuff like that. So that's family stuff, and it doesn't go away. But you can incorporate that into a family story.
Oh, totally. And the other thing is just like, there's just a point where for me over the past like 5 to 7 years or so, if I sniff a lie, or if I sniff deceit, then it's just like that's problematic really fast for me. And I have to like go, okay, what? And sometimes the person doesn't even deserve an okay what. It's just like, just walk backwards slowly, because I don't want that energy around me in any way at all. And it scares me that, especially if I and I've been working we can go into my psychological background, but that would be an 8-hour episode, and as you say, the story would get really boring. It would be for me, but it's
therapeutic.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's like, I don't want that to rub off on me either. I like my ex-wife, she used to lie all the time during our marriage to her friends right in front of me. And I look at her and be like, what are you doing? That's inviting bad. I didn't know that I was like, I should be running to the hills, which is now, but I just thought she was just lying to them. It turned out, oh no, she's lying to me as well. But I didn't know that, and it utterly shocked me. But at the same time, if I was a little more mature, I would have said, oh, of course. But it's just like, even little things like, We would be in the car going to a museum, and one of her good friends would call, and she goes, "I'm at work now. I really can't talk. Can I call you later?" And I was just like, why don't you just tell her we're going to a museum? And she's just like, "I just didn't want to deal with it." And I'm just like, that brings really bad energy. People can sniff that. They don't know why, but they know there's something a little wrong and a little off. And that's why I don't even want to be near people like that, because if maybe they'll sniff it off of me a little bit because I'm around this other person that's doing it. This is how scared I get of my energy.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I have an acquaintance down here. He's a topper. No matter what you're talking about, he's got to invent some story to top it. And you know, you can see him spinning it. He's actually a storyteller, but he can't construct a story based on just, he does it about, he builds it lie upon lie upon lie. Yeah. And which is what we do in fiction. In a way.
Right. Well, we're craft. I think in fiction, we're telling the emotion. We're also telling the emotional truth. And we're also giving the handshake to the reader that this is fiction. And guess what? You're going to find some emotional truth in there.
Exactly. I mean, because I think fiction often gets to the truthful core of things in ways that nonfiction can't.
Exactly.
And so that's why we write it. But it gets boring when people do that too.
Yeah.
You go flat.
And, yeah.
And I actually don't like to go flat with people. I like to engage with them because people have things to say or, you know, and you want to hear it. And yeah. Sometimes you just, but you don't want to hear them fabricate or embellish in such a way that it's, you know, that it's not true. Embellishment is fine on the page. In fact, we want it to a point.
Yeah.
And so, I agree with you. It just, and no matter how you look at it, not all lies damage in the same way, but every lie creates damage somewhere and somehow. Yeah. It may be just a little prick, and you know, like you were talking about your wife lying in front of you to others. Each one of those built on another one.
Yeah.
Even though it wasn't about the same thing, it was just each one until you cut it off.
Yeah.
It's damaging. It damages relationships, and look at the lies that are told on both sides in politics.
Yeah.
They do, especially because of the internet and everything, they're doing damage that may be irreparable in some cases, but they do.
Yeah.
They take a seed of truth and embellish it in some way that it becomes a lie and people buy it.
And I feel like that's why instead of consuming news, I consume novels.
It's like, good idea.
I want to get to the truth, man.
I'm the same way. I think 50 minutes of news every week is sufficient. Is adequate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It news generally speaking doesn't refresh you in any way.
Right.
But a really good sentence that comes out unexpectedly, and you look at it and you go, where the hell? Yeah. And then you go, oh yeah, that's refreshing.
I just read Wiseblood for the first time by Flannery O'Connor. And in my journal, I was like rewriting sentences because she's just amazing and off the hook. And I'm like, oh my God, I wish she lived longer because I would love to have seen her mid-career years of novels, because there was magic there. And
I agree with you entirely. I mean, I think she's one of the most masterful sentence writers. She told a story too. I mean, it wasn't just about writing those sentences. They all came to coalesce in state. And I liked dark stories too, and she knew how to write darkness so that it spoke of human of the human condition, not in a way that I don't know about you, but I really, killing is part of the world.
Yeah.
But I really don't want my fiction to focus on murderers or stuff like that.
Yeah.
There's room for it, but we get it. We get enough of it in real life.
You're very true. Yeah. I'm careful with I just don't even understand the obsession with like serial killer TV shows and true crime stuff. And I'm like, I don't want anywhere near that. Cause that hurts my soul that's really happening. And I don't want to even get behind the why of it. It just, these people are insane.
Yeah. Just anybody that victimizes children, I mean, that's, there's things that are beyond the pale.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess I was raised in that masculine world where there were rules, you know, you did no harm to women, children, or animals, pets,
yeah.
By which I mean domesticated animals. You don't, yeah. You just simply don't do that. That's beyond the pale to do it.
Yeah.
And so I have no sympathy for the people that get convicted of those crimes and get, I want to see them serve life in prison and suffer you know, the worst thing you can be in prison is or go there as a child molester.
Oh yeah.
But that's where they belong.
Right. It's insane. When did you know you were a writer? When did you start putting pen to paper and go, oh, wait a second, I think this is my thing.
Okay, this is gets a little complicated. I was involved. I was a narcotics agent. I think you know that background. No, you didn't.
No, yeah, no. Wow.
I was a narcotics agent with the state of Nevada, and I was assigned to a narcotics task force by under the feds in Reno, and. There's a background to it that I won't go into, but anyhow, I was involved in a shooting and it got controversial, and the sheriff's department up there came after me, and so I went through, I eventually resigned, walked away from police work entirely. Well, I had to, kind of, after gone through what I went through, and it carried forward with me, and I was angry for a while. And the only thing that kept my anger in check at all was playing tennis and writing. I sat down to write the story, and I tried to write it as a novel, and I realized I was too close to it. It didn't work as a novel, but I had 300 pages when it was all over with. And I wrote, by the way, printed it, handwritten on legal pad, and then had
that's how I do that's how I do all my first drafts, by the way. So it's, yeah, I'm just like, yeah, of course you do.
It's a perfect way. I would go back to it if I but anyhow, and then I used to send I sent it out, and I knew I would get rejected, but what I learned was that I had the discipline to sit down and write every day.
Oh yeah.
And I had things to say, I just needed to develop it. And so I actually wrote for a long period of time. I have, you know, two novels that are actually, under the circumstances, I would say were publishable out of that period. But that was, you know, the old way where you sent out the hard copy, you know, and agents looked at it and everything. They never got picked up. But I had a Vietnam novel, A Medal for Joey. And I had an agent, Phyllis Tornetta, who loved it. And she sent it to all four of the major publishers at the time. And the rejections were pretty much the same. This is 1977 and 1978. And they all said, we don't think America's ready to read about Vietnam yet in fiction. They're just not ready for it. And of course, it wasn't but a year or so, year and a half after that, that Tim O'Brien came out with Going After Cacciato. And, you know, that caught the flame. And then people started getting published about Vietnam. And I like to say that actually the Vietnam War, the only real reason it was started was for Tim O'Brien to have something to write about.
So thanks, Tim. Thanks for all the death.
But he, so anyhow, his, he caught on after that, and then he wrote his the things they carried and everything. And so I was just, it was ill-timed, all of that.
Yeah.
And then I went back to, you know, in my, I was 39. I went back to college, got my bachelor's degree, studied English literature.
Oh, wow.
Everything. Okay. And then went off and got my MFA, worked full time the whole period of time that I was doing all of this. And it was about 4 years after I had my, got my MFA that Gunning for Home, my first collection of short fiction, was picked up. And since then, there were 10 novels, and now number 11. This one is, Emerald City Blues is due to be released tomorrow.
Yeah. Actually today, because that's when it, so because we're taping right now. So this airs tomorrow. So it's today? What?
Oh, Emerald well, City now I
Blues, really... the novel?
Is the world ready for it?
Yeah.
I hope so. I hope so. I really, you know, I went out on the limb initially writing it in the first person with a female voice, a 19-year-old female voice, or a mature woman looking back at her 19-year-old self. And I wasn't confident for a while. Then I sent it to two of my friends who are hardcore feminist writers.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them told me, you got to go on. Essentially that. One said, "It, I believe her, it works." And the other one said, it's a story that has to be told about them. So that was my moment of enthusiasm about the work. And then I went into the, I was probably in a third draft stage at that.
Yeah.
And then I went into final draft. And it sat before I picked it up. It sat for 18 years.
Wow.
And then I pulled it out again and started working on it.
Why do you think you put it aside for that long?
I had other things that I was writing.
Okay.
That I had to focus on. And I had always, you know, I started that with some trepidation because, you know, it's a female voice and it's set in that day and time. The inspiration for it was actually going to visit a friend of mine in Southern California and then going to San Pedro and walking the area around San Pedro. You're from California, right?
Yeah, from San Francisco Bay Area. I live in Los Angeles now, but like the last time I was in San Pedro was probably in the 1990s. So you know how Los Angeles is, sprawl.
Yeah. So. but so much of World War II is captured there.
Mm.
If you walk the pier and you look out at Terminal Island and everything, and then that YMCA that's there, you walk in, that's where they held the USOs. And it was almost haunted with the stories that were there. And that's when that began. And I wrote it in a first draft and then started a second draft on it. And then I set it aside and was working on some other stuff. And in the meantime, I had, you know, things accepted for publication. And I went along with that. So, you know, before it was all over with, I had 10 books published. And this was number 11 coming out today.
Coming up, by the way. This is number 11 out now.
Yeah. That was a long period of time to wait to get back to it. But I felt that there was something strong in it, and I was encouraged by. I trust very few people, but those two women I truly trust their views. We've talked about a lot of things and over the years, and I was confident. That gave me the confidence to start pitching it. And I was surprised that Nevada Press picked it up. I got rejections from about a half dozen, I would say, agents. You know, part of it is, you know, what's your platform out there in the world? My shoes when I work, when I walk.
Yeah.
They want to know you have 7,000 followers on Facebook or something.
Which is just so gross, because that could be so fabricated. Like, people just, you could fabricate that. It doesn't make any sense. It's like, I believe at some point, hopefully people will get a little more, I guess, because it doesn't actually mean sales. I mean, I understand, because I'm querying agents right now on a novel, and I understand that they with nonfiction, they really want to know what you're doing, because you have to be an expert or whatever. They want the author expert, so they can pitch that into, you know, an Oprah episode. But for novelists, it's just like, you got to look at the craft, man. If it's a good book, that word of mouth is pretty sexy, you know?
Yeah, that's what you hope for.
Yeah.
You hope for some longevity. And I think her voice on the page is comes off honest. And she tells a story. They have adventures. And there's themes in there that are important and relevant today, just as they were in those days. There's, you know, racism is in there, and as is the whole idea of the emergence of the feminine as a different kind of femininity, one where they can assert themselves, where they can go into the world and be successful at what they do and contribute and be recognized for their contributions. They don't have to be famous to do that. They can do it in their small sphere. And they passed that on to their daughters. And those are the daughters that went out and started the strong feminist movement that took place in the 60s. Because the early feminists back in the turn of the century and prior to that, and fought for women's rights to vote, that was a different kind of feminism. That was a struggle, just civil rights struggle for them at that moment. It wasn't, you know, so much to be recognized as full human beings the same way that men recognize one another, just simply to engage in the same kind of rights that men did.
Yeah.
You know, and then came the Depression, and then came World War II, and those women who emerged in World War II to do the work in the factories and everything, all of them. I mean, that they contributed greatly to the victory.
Yeah. It's like every little bit counts. No, but you know, even, I mean, even though, your half brother's, you know, lying about what he did when he was serving, it's also like, there's a guy that needs to hand out uniforms. Like, it all has to come Absolutely. Together, you know?
Absolutely. That's why I get mad at him. Because it's all contribution, and it's all twice a year, actually, I do it on Memorial Day. We have a Veterans Corner down here in this community, and on Memorial Day and on Veterans Day, I give a talk, and I emphasize that everybody who contributes during this to this cause, whatever it may be, you don't have to be out there getting shot at and everything else to something worthy for you for during your service. It's all honorable service, and it's towards a very, I mean, who's more important to the guy in the field than the mechanic who's working on the jet aircraft and making sure that it's going to fly? Because you, when you're out there in the field, you want that communication with that pilot up there to come in. Save your butt. That's what you want.
Yeah. Did you have to, were you in combat when you were in Vietnam?
Yeah. I was, okay. I actually was in Special Forces. I wrote my memoir.
Yeah.
I was a Green Beret.
Okay.
And I wrote, When We Walked Above the Clouds is my memoir for that year. And I was actually in combat. I lost four teammates within 20 days of the time that we were in Vietnam. You deal with things, and I can tell you that I've captured some of the images from that in that memoir that I think people should be exposed to understand. I mean, the single worst thing I saw was two women prostrate over this dead Vietnamese soldier, both of them wailing. And I assume by looking at them as briefly as I did, that one was a mother and one was a wife or a sister. Yeah. And those mournful wails just stayed with me.
Yeah.
They haunted me, you know, 30, 40, 50 years later. It's not that I went back to Vietnam because of it, but I went back to that moment because you understand for the first time that the cost of war isn't just the cost of one human life. It's the chain of lives that are affected by those events, especially loss. Loss is, I mean, look at wonderful news, 20 living hostages from that were returned today.
Yeah.
And that's great. Their families got to hug them and everything. But what about those hostages that weren't returned and their families didn't get to hug them? And that's the kind of thing that, and I said, even tough guys, and I consider myself, when I was younger, a fairly tough guy, even tough guys come to terms with it in another way. You get, it softens you. It makes you more empathetic to greater losses. So
I want to read the memoir now too. Yeah.
Well, I think you might enjoy it. I don't mean it that way. I mean, the language in it is worth it. I think I wrote a pretty good memoir.
Yeah. Well, it just fascinates me. I mean, I was born in 1969, so I wasn't there, but I was there. You know, so I was absorbing my parents' energies and the family energies of the time, probably at that.
Oh yeah. I'm sure that your family, if your family wasn't directly involved in the Vietnam War in some way, they were indirectly through friends they went to school with, or relatives, or one thing or another. Yeah. It was as bad as the cloud hangs over Nixon for Watergate and the rest of that stuff. He did save and thousands upon thousands of lives by bringing it to an end. And I to this day, I don't think that we were dishonorable in what we did in Vietnam as a whole, but was it really necessary? You could argue that it was necessary politically, but politicians start, and soldiers don't start wars. Politicians do.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
And the politicians aren't at the front lines, and the politicians aren't experiencing the loss.
The Gulf of Tonkin incident was just something to promote LBJ, I think, and his agenda. He wanted a war. For whatever reason, I mean, it just seems to me that he wanted a war because he kept expanding it. And the way it was set up initially with advisors out there and special forces working with the Vietnamese, yes, there were some American losses and there was a war and people were dying. But I don't think it energized the North Vietnamese the way that putting conventional soldiers on the ground did. That energized them. They got their, and they rallied their nation and their people. And, you know, because in the early stages, it was just the Viet Cong and the North and the South Vietnamese government soldiers and our advisors. Gulf of Tonkin changed that. And thousands of lives, tens of thousands of lives were lost. On our side, just Americans, never mind the other side.
Yeah. The human condition is is messy. It's messy stuff.
Thank you.
That's why I feel like For myself, even, my petite traumas that I've had, being able to just write and write every day keeps my head straight, in a way.
Oh, it's the best discipline there is, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, and I've done, I played tennis and martial arts and all that stuff. But honest to God, it keeps you going for 1 hour to 2 hours, sometimes 3 hours, and not everything that you put down is going to be usable, but it's usable at that time. Because you're doing it, and that's it's the best discipline there is, I think.
I agree. That's why you're here, sir. His name is H. Lee Barnes. The book is called Emerald City Blues, a novel. It's out today. Lee, thanks for coming on the show.
You very, very much for having me. It was nice talking to you. You're quite a character yourself.
Well, thank you. And cut. All right. That was good. H. Lee Barnes on Drinks with Tony. Check out his new book released today. And remember, if you'd like your holiday break to put together your future screenplay outline, join me for the 10-day screenplay outline workshop. A link for registration is at drinkswithtony.com and an early bird discount is available. That's drinkswithtony.com if you'd like to join me during the holidays and want to get a head start on your writing project. No experience necessary. I'll guide you through the entire process. I've worked with screenwriters who have a body of produced work to people who just have a vague idea at the beginning of this exact workshop I'll be teaching. So get in on the action and start 2026 right with your screenplay outline ready for prime time. Go to drinkswithtony.com for the registration link. And no matter what you do, just like Lee and I talked about during this episode, just write. Write every day. It helps you think better. It levels up your conversational skills. And chicks and dudes dig it. I'm Tony Duchesne. I'll see you next week. You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz.
Six altars. southern tree. Looking at us.